You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we look at how to handle bullies in the workplace in light of Bob Garfield's dismissal from New York Public Radio for violating the company's anti-bullying policy. Now, Republican state lawmakers have voted to reinstate work search requirements for people on unemployment in Wisconsin, and they say they'll take up legislation next month that would end a $300 weekly federal unemployment supplement months ahead of schedule. Those are moves being cheered by our next guest, who says businesses in the state can't find enough workers to fill open jobs. You can join this conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you relying on one of these pandemic unemployment programs? What do the benefits mean to you? Maybe you're a business owner who is struggling to fill open positions. Help us understand at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Ahead on Central Time, we'll hear from an advocate for people on unemployment in Wisconsin. Now, our guest is Kurt Bauer. He's the president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce. That's the state's largest business lobbying group. Kurt, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here.
You say unemployment benefits and the worker shortage are some of the top concerns of your members. What are you hearing from them?
Well, it was the biggest problem prior to COVID-19, and even during the worst of the pandemic, when we got to nearly 15% unemployment, many businesses were still having trouble finding people. And now that we are coming out of COVID-19, it has really been exacerbated, particularly by the $300 supplemental provided in the American Rescue Plan that was passed in March, the federal legislation pushed by President Biden. And that augments what you would get from state unemployment insurance benefits. So you're basically making $16.75 per hour. And that has been a detriment, a deterrent for people to get back to work. And you talk to any business around the state in any sector, particularly I've been talking to a lot of manufacturing and hospitality, it's at a crisis point.
Would this problem be remedied if employers raised wages to pay people more than what they'd get on unemployment?
Well, wages are definitely rising. I mean, the data points show that. And if you pay attention to, you know, businesses that have posting signs looking for workers, you know, they're raising their pay. They've got hiring bonuses, offering free meals, flexible hours, more time off. So we are seeing that. So the question is that how do you balance the supply and demand component of this? There is more demand for labor than there is supply with, the law of competition that you have in business. And, of course, then what your customers are willing to pay for a product or service. Because keep in mind, if you raise one cost, it has to be accounted for one way or the other in a business. I mean, they have to balance their budgets. They're not like government that can just run deficits or debts with impunity. You've got to figure out a way to make things balance out. So if one cost goes up, you have to adjust someplace along the line. So for most businesses, labor is your number one cost of doing business. If your labor costs go up, you have to decide, am I going to raise the cost for my product or service? Will my customers pay that? Maybe they buy less. Maybe they don't buy at all. Maybe they buy from a competitor that doesn't have the same problem, somebody overseas that doesn't have a labor shortage. I mean, all of this stuff has to be factored into it.
We are taking calls at 800-642-1234 throughout this conversation. Sandy in Mineral Point wants to join the conversation. Hi, Sandy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Employers need to understand that unless they pay a living wage, people aren't going to want to work for them. And as far as where they find the money, when you've got CEOs making multiple millions of dollars, cut the CEO pay.
All right, Sandy, thanks for that. And Kurt, what is your response to Sandy saying there are ways that you can find more money in the budget to raise wages if you want to avoid having people make more on unemployment?
Well, I think I just explained it. I may go through it again, but the reality is that it's just not that simple. Anybody who's actually run a business and had to balance a budget understands this. Most businesses operate on very tight margins, and business in Wisconsin is basically small business. We're the largest business group in the state. We're often associated with big business, but the reality is that most of our members, and we have 800 of them, have 100 or less employees. CEOs are, that's just not the case in Wisconsin. We do have some CEOs that do very, very well, but that's just not the way it's working. And in particular, as we look at the tourism season and we look at these restaurants and resorts that are desperate to try and find workers, I guarantee you that they're not exactly enjoying lavish wages.
If it's not just about the bottom line and people are looking at it and going, well, I could even make more if I went back to work right now, but I haven't found a job that feels safe, should employers wait a few months while vaccinations rise to see if more people will go back to work on their own? Or do you think they have to make the change now?
I think they need to make it now. I mean, the CDC is saying that it's safe to go back to work. And frankly,
if you're vaccinated or wear a mask if you're not.
Well, and vaccines are widely available and free. So, and of course, you can still wear a mask and you can still socially distance. Many of our employers have gone to great lengths to rearrange their workspaces. I mean, we certainly have here at our building in downtown Madison with social distancing and removing chairs and partitions. So, and you see that everywhere. Businesses have done what they need to make sure that people are safe on the job. And frankly, they don't get the credit, I think, that they deserve. The safest place for most people from COVID-19 is on the job because of the precautions that business owners have taken.
Kurt Bauer is the president and CEO of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's largest business lobbying group. And we are talking about whether unemployment benefits need to be taken down from the federal supplement for them to encourage people to go back to work. And we are taking your calls. And we have Nancy in the North Woods who wants to join the conversation. Good afternoon, Nancy.
Hi there. How are you?
Good. Thanks. What's on your mind?
Well, I just have, there's a little bit of a loyalty back and forth. And when Wisconsin shut down for the 5 weeks that they shut down, because we really weren't shut down that long, we went back open pretty much May 24th last year. Employers didn't really worry about their employees. They cut them out, got rid of their positions and everything like that. And now they want the employees to come back to work for them because they need them now. And, they just kind of let them go.
All right. Thanks for that point, Nancy. And Kurt, whether companies or businesses didn't care about their employees or simply could not keep paying them because of the shutdowns, Nancy's point seems to be that, employers couldn't be there for the workers. How do you expect workers to come back? What do you say to that?
Well, I don't think it's a fair point. We had a payroll protection plan in the original CARES Act a year ago, March, that incentivized businesses to keep people on the payroll. They did if they could afford to. Keep in mind, the economy was shut down, and just because some people were able to come back to work at the end of May doesn't mean others were. Hospitality, restaurants, entertainment venues certainly were not able to go back to work. And, of course, you were only able to go back to work if you had orders for whatever it is, product or service that you provide. Because at that point, that's when we reached peak unemployment at 15%. The economy stalled because of a government-imposed shutdown. So I just don't think it's a fair point at all.
Do talk about some of the ways that not having enough workers affects a business.
Well, we're seeing a variety of things. So I live here in Madison, and not too long ago, I went to a restaurant, and it wasn't very busy, but it was going to be a 40-minute wait, and the hostess told me, I've got two servers and one cook, and it was because of this $300 supplemental. People don't want to work. So that's one example. But, for our manufacturers, many of them are not able to run multiple shifts. They're not bidding for contracts. They're not able to perhaps meet the terms of the contracts that they have right now, which could really have a negative impact in the future because, they're not going to have work later on. So, if people are waiting to get back to work after the $300 supplemental expires in Labor Day, there may not be those jobs available because the businesses, will have gone under or have really reduced capacity.
Yeah, lots to think about and lots of different pieces that go into the decisions. Kurt, we appreciate your time today.
No, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Kurt Bauer, who's head of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, the state's largest business lobby. And he was with us today to talk about why he wants Governor Tony Evers to end pandemic unemployment benefits in Wisconsin, that federal money that comes in on top of regular unemployment benefits. Up next, we'll hear from a Wisconsin unemployment advocate about why she thinks the benefits are still important. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think we should stop those enhanced unemployment benefits, or do you think they should stay in place through September when they're slated to expire? What would the effect on businesses around you be? Call 800-642-1234. The conversation continues here on Central Time. Federal leaders included money for additional unemployment benefits in coronavirus relief. Advocates say that's saving Wisconsin's families. Business leaders argue it's keeping people from working. We're talking about those perspectives here on Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're discussing whether to end pandemic unemployment benefits in Wisconsin. And you can join in. You can call 800-642-1234 or email your story or your question to ideas@wpr.org. Are you a business owner? Are you having trouble filling positions? Do you think this extra unemployment benefit is affecting the pool of applicants you have? Give us a call or email ideas@wpr.org. Shannon Hussey joins us now. She's the co-founder of the Wisconsin Unemployment Action Group. That's a group that advocates for people who on unemployment in this state. Shannon, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What has having access to pandemic unemployment programs meant to people in Wisconsin?
You know, it's been a real lifesaver, save for the issues with the unemployment department actually getting payments to people. When they do receive those payments, it has maintained not lifestyles. People have definitely had to cut back, but it has met the gap between being able to feed their families and put a roof over their families' heads. So it's been essential.
What do you think could happen if these unemployment benefits end early? They are going to end in September.
Well, you know, they're going to end in September, and there are some calls to extend them. And I think in some circumstances, when it comes to safety and health, we don't know what it's going to look like in September. So it's hard to project that far. But ending them before then, we know that only 40% of Wisconsin is vaccinated. Kids under 12 can't be vaccinated, and they're still carriers. They can still be sick. But more importantly, we have to look at the workers. And I understand that business is important. And Kurt made it very clear that when you look at the money side of a business, it's not simple. I have an MBA. I understand that. But you can't cut down workers and pay them less simply because you had a rising cost in another department. That's not where your cut should be.
We are taking calls, and we've got Andrew in River Falls who is ready to join our conversation. Hey, Andrew.
Hi. Yeah, I'd like to just bring up the fact that a lot of people aren't returning to work because they've got kids to watch. You know, I understand the school season is ending now, but during the school season, most schools weren't back in person full time. They had kids at home, and parents needed to be there with them. And childcare costs are really expensive. You know, that takes a huge chunk of paycheck to cover childcare. So, you know, that's something that needs to be accounted for and considered as well, I think.
Andrew, thanks for bringing that up. And Shannon, Andrew is helping us complicate this conversation, right? That it's not just one thing. It's not about the level of pay necessarily, but there are life factors that affect people who are getting unemployment benefits right now.
Absolutely. There are barriers to employment right now that we have to address. And you're correct. That is the bigger issue, where we have mudslinging about, no, we need to keep benefits. No, we need to take them away. We need workers. Instead of just making that the end of the conversation, we need to have solution-based conversations. And he is right. Childcare is a major barrier. Larger facilities are open. They're open at a smaller capacity. They have higher needs to put those safety protocols in place. So the cost of childcare has gone up, and they have been able to offer a higher pay for their employees because of the many factors as well. They haven't decreased pay, but they certainly have not been able to increase it. We also deal with transportation, criminal histories. A lot of these employers that are looking for workers still have all of these requirements. And let's face it, people can't meet it.
So we heard from Joel on Facebook, who says there are more jobs than applicants for those jobs. No one should elect to continue to collect unemployment benefits if a suitable job is available. What do you say to Joel?
I say, Joel, have you looked at the definition set in place by Republicans in our unemployment statutes of what a suitable job is? A suitable job is a job that is in the industry you previously worked in, a job that is within a dollar per hour of your last wage, a job that is within 30 miles of your home, or not farther than your last employer. So there are things that are in the camp of the workers, as to they are looking, they are searching, but we can't force people into a labor market that puts even more stress and pressure on them. Because it's not going to work out. And we have, and he's right, there are more jobs than people. And Kurt, you know, he actually said it best. This isn't a new problem, especially in manufacturing. They have just as many job openings now as they did pre-pandemic. They just have something to blame it on now.
Shannon Hussey is the co-founder of the Wisconsin Unemployment Action Group, and we're talking about a Republican plan to take up legislation to stop paying the supplemental federal unemployment insurance to people in Wisconsin during the pandemic ahead of the September expiration of that. You can email your questions and your comments to ideas@wpr.org. And now let's bring on Bill in Superior. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. I agree that the extra benefits should be cut, and I have 2 points to make on that. One, there's a sense of entitlement in 2021 where everybody, even new workers, believe that they are worth $30 an hour straight out of high school when their skill set is only $10 an hour. And all the lower-paying jobs, somebody still has to do them. My second point is that during this unemployment, while everybody getting this extra unemployment, there's way too many jobs available out there. So when an employer calls up, say, Sam, and says, Sam, I'm ready, you need to come back to work, and Sam says, no, I'm on unemployment. Well, that employer needs to contact unemployment and tell unemployment to cancel his benefits because he was told to come back to work or work was available, and he denied work.
Hmm. Bill, thanks for those comments, and I want to make sure that Shannon has a chance to respond. I'm sorry about that. What is your response to Bill thinking people expect more than they can be reasonably paid for jobs?
You know, I actually did a poll in our Facebook group today asking people in their job search what hourly wage are they looking for that meets their expenses, and the average response was between $20 and $24 an hour. And that's respectable for an adult in a skilled job. Just to go back to what Bill just said, you can't expect a 35-year-old to go flip burgers at McDonald's for $10 an hour. I just can't comprehend that. And those are a lot of the jobs that are available right now that you can just walk in off the street and get a job. And anybody can put a sign up in the window or in the front lawn that says now hiring up to $27 per hour. And everything sounds great until you get your job offer and you're ready to go to training. And the paperwork says $12 an hour. You question it and they say, well, that's what you start at. We'll reevaluate it in 6 months. And then it takes 10 years to get up to the actual hourly wage that they offered. I do agree that people need to be realistic and what they're looking for. But the service industry, and I actually pulled up the data today with Wisconsin labor statistics, the service industry hasn't changed their hourly offerings. We're talking an average of $12 an hour for hard labor. You can't cover childcare. You can't even pay your rent with that. The living wage in Wisconsin is $27 an hour.
Governor Tony Evers had said he'd likely veto legislation to end that $300 supplement, but he says he hasn't made up his mind yet. What concerns do you have if he actually doesn't veto the bill?
This could be an answer that could go on for a long time because we sure. We haven't heard anything from Tony Evers when it comes to unemployment period. which baffles me. There are thousands of people affected, hundreds of thousands of people affected in this state by unemployment. And he, to even say that he hasn't made up his mind goes against everything he campaigned on. And people need to be aware of the situation. People that are on unemployment, that are trying to find a job and haven't found one yet that fits their skill set. Because let's face it, everybody that's looking for a job right now, they're not from manufacturing. So why would they be going to manufacturing? They're looking for a job they're good at. But Tony Evers has to respond. He has to speak up and support the people that put him in office.
So you're saying that you think there's a skills mismatch with the jobs that are available and the things and the people who are looking for them?
Absolutely. The office industry has not rebounded yet. The meeting industry hasn't rebounded yet. A lot of the people that used to have those positions that were making $20 to $25 an hour, they were let go, and those offices either haven't opened or they have cut back the number of employees they have to maintain a profit level. And they're not going to do a factory job. We're talking about people that are 40 plus years old. They can't do that kind of labor consistently for 10 to 12 hours.
Yeah. A lot to talk about here. Shannon, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, no problem. Thank you for having me.
That was Shannon Hussey, who's co-founder of the Wisconsin Unemployment Action Group. She was with us today to talk about why she thinks Wisconsin should keep pandemic unemployment benefits in place. And earlier in the program, we heard from the head of Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce about why he thinks the benefits should actually end. Longtime New York Public Radio host Bob Garfield was fired this week after two investigations found he violated the company's anti-bullying policy. Garfield co-hosted On the Media for two decades. In a tweet, he denied it was bullying, saying it was an issue of anger mismanagement. The On the Media team tweeted support for the move. You can call 800-642-1234. What questions come to mind when you think about bullying in the workplace? What do you want to know about how to handle it? 800-642-1234. Ryan Martin is a psychologist and the associate dean for the College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW Green Bay. He wrote the book, Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. Ryan, welcome back to Central Time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
As we see this careful public discourse surrounding On the Media, it brings up this idea that it's sometimes difficult to figure out what the line is between being human and making mistakes and being bullying or creating a really dangerous or uncomfortable environment. How do you want us to try to think about that?
Yeah, you know, there's a few things. And I think first, you know, we talk about this. In this instance, he talked about anger mismanagement. But I think it's also worth noting how he really minimized. In fact, he goes on to say, you know, the provocations were just shocking, really putting the onus of responsibility on those provocations. And that's pretty common for angry people to do, that they see this. They like to sort of think about how their anger is caused by something else and not necessarily something they own.
So how do we spot a bully in the workplace? What behavior should we be watching for?
Yeah, it can be really subtle. There's the obvious things, right? The harsh criticisms, humiliation. But we can also see some passive aggression. We can see some constant jokes at someone's expense that are really sort of targeted at a particular person. But those things oftentimes look like bullying, too. Or are bullying too, I should say. And then to add to that, you know, I guess when it comes to spotting it, one of the things we know is that it's associated with power. So a supervisor is going to, more often than not, it'll be a supervisor, but it can be a coworker, so someone of an equal status. Every now and then, it's someone of sort of lower in the hierarchy, but that's relatively rare.
So what do you do then if you feel like you're being bullied, especially if that person is in a supervisory role?
Yeah, so I think I'd start by pointing out how this can really have consequences, not just to the victim of the bullying, but to the organization itself. And so one of the best ways to prevent it is for institutions to work hard to have a a system in place or a structure in place that's going to keep this to a minimum, because it's associated with lack of productivity, decreased morale, absenteeism, turnover, all sorts of things. Now, what can you do if you are the victim? There's a couple things. One thing I would really encourage is for people to document and to actually save evidence. So keep, you know, write down the examples of them as they are happening to you. If there is actual like email, like a paper trail, things like that, you know, keep that evidence. It's good for people to be aware of the workplace policies they have. You know, and so what does the workplace say, if anything, about bullying? What are some of the policies in place? That could include a conversation with HR, depending on what level this is at. It could include that. Ultimately, I think one of the things you say in confronting the person is obviously a really a big thing, especially if we're talking about a supervisor. It's smart to bring a witness, bring someone else in to be involved in that. Those are all things that we can consider in these types of situations.
These are clear, you know, sensical tips, and yet some supervisors might question that. If you say, I really need to have this other person with us, I'd like to talk about it and just have someone along with me. How do you do that while maybe being worried that that might backfire on you?
I mean, I think that is the real challenge that we're dealing with here. And one of the things that makes this so unfortunate and so dangerous is that we really are, when we're dealing with a power issue and we're dealing with someone in power, the consequences can be pretty severe. And that kind of conversation can go badly, especially if the person is not receptive. People do have, this is going to depend on the state and the nature of things. People do have legal rights in these scenarios. And so again, if, you know, at a certain point, one of the things people often advise is, you know, start looking for other work, but that is easier said than done. And I know that. And so it might be that for some people, they need to consider meeting with an attorney to find out what their legal rights are and so on. Again, that depends how bad this is, the impact it's having on you, the impact it's having on your family, and so on.
Yeah. We're talking with Ryan Martin, who's a psychologist and also wrote the book, Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. And we're talking about how to handle bullying in the workplace, what it looks like, how to identify it, and then how to try to deal with it. You're listening to this conversation here on the Ideas Network. You just acknowledged, you know, it is hard for people who can't leave their jobs, financial reasons, because they need health care. There are so many reasons. So if, you know, what are other things that someone who thinks they're being bullied at work can do if they're unable to leave, maybe even to figure out, is this really happening? Because sometimes in these conversations, people get called too sensitive or people are told that's not what's happening to them.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that is important to think about here is that what is reinforcing the bullying behavior in the first place? You know, if we're thinking about this as an anger problem, part of the reason that exists, especially the more overt sort of criticism, the humiliation, that sort of thing, one of the things we see is that the bully doesn't necessarily recognize it as a problem. They actually sort of see it as almost like a management style. They think about, oh, look, I'm, you know, well, ultimately they're rewarded for it because people don't cross them. They don't make mistakes as often and so forth, or at least in theory. So in the short term, it's rewarded. The one way of dealing with that, especially early on, if a person is trying to sort of set a tone for how they want to be interacted with, it can be, you can have a direct conversation. You can work on saying, yep, you know, having that conversation saying, yeah, I'm going to do what you said. I didn't love the way you asked, or I didn't love that you were doing this. It was hurtful to me. You know, there are times where I think we should remember that bullies are humans too, and that there might be a way of working with them directly.
So if you can channel your own anger or frustration with the situation and put that into a kind of a solutions mindset, you might actually be able to get somewhere with someone?
Yeah, I think so. You know, a lot of times it's not unheard of. I know we like to think sometimes that this bully is just a monster and that they're being mean. And that's probably true sometimes. I think sometimes, though, it's a way of interacting that they haven't necessarily just been challenged on. And it seems like it's working to them, or it feels to them like it's working, because they get what they want out of it. And once they become more aware of some of the consequences, whether it's to the person they're working with or to the organization they're working for, they might start thinking about other ways of dealing with it.
And as you try to work through a situation like that, you also mentioned affecting family life or home life, things outside of work, probably even your productivity at work if you don't feel like you're in a safe space. You know, with your psychologist hat on, how can we work through those situations and try not to let that affect employees so much if they're dealing with someone that does seem to be bullying them?
Yeah, I think for the person who is being bullied, if it does feel as though or seem that there is no real escape, which can be the case, you know, given all the, again, given the power piece here, it feels like they can't get out of this at least right away. I think it's good to think about embracing some psychological approaches to dealing with it. So stress management, some therapeutic approaches, meeting with a therapist or a counselor, starting to, because you're absolutely right, that the stress that can accompany that, the worry that can accompany that, takes its toll on both mental and physical health. And so emotion regulation strategies, stress reduction strategies, all of those might be important, especially as you're trying to find a solution.
Yeah, it doesn't make the bullying okay, but maybe it can affect you a little bit less personally,
right?
Then.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan, exactly. Thank you for talking with us about this.
You bet. Thank you so much for having me.
Ryan Martin is a psychologist and also the Associate Dean for the Colleges of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences at UW Green Bay. He's the author of Why We Get Mad, How to Use Your Anger for Positive Change. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Starting this fall, Milwaukee Area Technical College will offer a 16-week course geared toward getting people with high-functioning autism started in manufacturing careers. The program is a collaboration with the Uniquely Abled Project. It trains people with high-functioning autism and works to place them in jobs that can start at $14 an hour. Laura Bray is the Vice President of College Advancement and External Communications at MATC in Milwaukee. Laura, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be here with you today.
And Ivan Rosenberg is the founder of the Uniquely Abled Project. Ivan, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Greatly appreciated.
Ivan, how did the idea for this project come about? What do you think? How do you think it can change things?
Well, two questions. How it came about is I have two children that with autism, and like with all parents of kids that have a diagnosis, I worried about what are they going to do when I'm no longer here? And the stats are pretty bad, 90% unemployment among those with autism. So I looked at that, and I also happen to be a management consultant working with A&D, aerospace and defense manufacturing firms. So I knew about manufacturing. And I saw there was a connection. And on one hand, you have companies just begging for people that can do well in manufacturing. And on the other side, you have 40 million people who have a diagnosis and love a job. And I said, these got to be solutions to each other. And that's how it started. And the next thing I saw, instead of calling people disabled, let's look at what they can do really well. And if you look at people with autism, again, statistically, with high-functioning autism, what they do really well is integrate with machines and do stuff. And so the CNC operating was a perfect match.
And Laura, what made MATC in Milwaukee the place for this pilot project?
Well, we have a really strong CNC program that has been working with employers in our district for many, many years. And in the Milwaukee area, there's actually 5.5 times more CNC jobs than the national average. You know, we're looking at so many people in the manufacturing industry retiring at the same time where we just have less younger people to fill those jobs. And the median pay for CNC operators here in Milwaukee is also higher than that nationally. So the median pay is about $44,000 a year, whereas nationally it's about $40,000. We know we have a really strong group of advocates and partners that work with individuals who are high functioning and those on the autism spectrum. And we thought we could really put together this national model to bring something new to the mix here in the Milwaukee area.
And you're saying CNC, and that stands for computer numerical control. So, Laura, what do CNC operators do?
Sure. The CNC operators really are an important part of in manufacturing, making all the little pieces that go into everything from, you know, Ivan works in building airplanes to all the manufacturers from like companies like Harley-Davidson to companies throughout our area. And it really is this fine machining that occurs, that for many years it was the tool and die industry, and now the evolution is that it's a lot of it is computerized.
Sure. And Ivan, you wanted this program to focus on CNC machine operating, is that right?
Well, that's what it turned out to be. It turned out that I knew a lot about autism and I knew a lot about CNC machining, and I saw the link. But clearly in the long run, what we're hoping is other diagnoses and other jobs will match, and there'll be uniquely abled academies for other combinations. I should say one thing that's unique about this is our placement rate out of the program is almost 100%. And that's really, there's no other program out there that has that kind of placement rate. And the employers are just delighted. And sometimes they get job offers during the interviews.
We're talking with Ivan Rosenberg, who's the founder of the Uniquely Abled Project. And also Laura Bray is with us. She's the Vice President of College Advancement and External Communications at MATC in Milwaukee. And we're talking about a program that's a collaboration that trains people with high functioning autism and helps to place them in jobs so that they can make money and contribute here in a way that is, you know, incredibly meaningful. And Laura, what is your vision for what this program could grow into with connecting people with specific opportunities and skills to the jobs that manufacturers or other companies need?
Well, I think what's so exciting about this program is that, and what I love the kind of paradigm shift that Ivan's doing really nationally, is that we have the opportunity to really hone in on people's skills and talents and unleash them in careers that are important to our economy. And so you're really having this opportunity to celebrate people's talents and match them up. So for CNC, the precision and the attention to detail and the management of complex operations are required to operate those machines. And those are the exact skills. And what we're hoping is that the stigma in the college system, people have to self-report to get accommodations. So they actually have to walk into an office and say, I have been labeled with a disability. What we want to be able to do is to open the doors and say, this is a part of a college system that's trying to identify and celebrate the talents that people have to offer the world. And that by saying you're a person that's on the spectrum, that is not something that's saying I have a disability. It's saying I have abilities to share. And we're here as a college and as a system to be able to match those up with the careers that we think you can really soar. Mm-hmm. And I think that's going to really change the way we operate as a college too.
Ivan, what kind of potential do you see if we shift our mindset that way?
Oh, it's almost unlimited. I see the kids with a diagnosis have been called disabled, and they've been told for most of their life that they aren't worth much and they'll never get a job and nobody will pay them. We look at them as uniquely abled, as Laura so well described. And all of a sudden, you not only have millions, I mean, there's 40 million people out there that have a diagnosis of disabled. You have people that are productive and happy and are producing and contributing, and their parents are proud of them instead of worried about them. I think that's a pretty significant shift in the society.
Well, and I mean, a parent brought this program to Milwaukee. What about the power of parents in creating opportunities for their kids?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, I got this phone call from Jamie Berger, or an email, I said, and something like, I've heard about your program. I'm interested. I have a son that might match. And we started the conversation, and that just went from there. And by the way, the same thing happened in Massachusetts. A mother in Plymouth called me and said, I've got a son that I think could really use your program, and I'm not moving to California. What do I do? And that program should open probably in September or January. The power of the parents is amazing.
Laura, what sort of things will people enrolling in the program be doing?
Sure. So the way that we have it set up is for a 16-week, they're going to be going through and they're going to be learning everything from like the safety practices in the machine shop, how to interpret engineer drawings, how to apply precision measuring methods, and perform the basic machine tooling equipment that we have. And that will really get them to the entry-level position as a CNC setup or operations individual. But all of those skills, they're actually earning credits that can be applied toward a technical diploma or associate degree. So they're going to be able to complete this curriculum and get in a job, but it ladders directly into our other degree programs so they could advance. And that means advance in pay and career responsibilities. So our hope is that this really is a progression path that they can be to a very, very comfortable, family sustaining wage and in a career that will be needed for many, many years to come.
Ivan, with those details and that framework, how do you hope to see the Uniquely Abled Project grow in the future?
Well, more Uniquely Abled Academies out there for CNC, and I think a shift in how we look at people with diagnoses from, as I say, from disabled to uniquely abled. And I think we're going to be able to see people that we only see what they're missing and see what can they do really well. And the Uniquely Abled Project hopes to be the spur for all that. But we really want a lot of other people to take up the mantle and contribute with new ideas. So we're just a little organization in LA. Our focus was to be scalable, which means we don't run any of the academies. We help them get started. We help them with the ideas. But if we tried to run everything, we would never get to work on the 40 million.
And how do you, I know we just have a moment left, but how do you help people understand the unique abilities of people?
Well, I'll say in Milwaukee, what we're doing as part of the program is that we're building in professional development for our faculty and for people that work at MATC as part of this initiative and part of the funding that the initial funding from some even parents who've helped us get this off the ground. But we're also going to be building that in to work with employers. So there might be different things that they do in a job interview or others that may that may set someone up to think that the individual isn't prepared, but it's just the social skills are different for those that are on the spectrum. And so we're trying to really focus on those abilities.
Laura, thank you so much for your time. And Ivan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
That was Ivan Rosenberg, who founded the Uniquely Able Project, and Laura Bray, Vice President of College Advancement and External Affairs at MATC in Milwaukee. They joined us to talk about the pilot program starting at MATC this fall, connecting autistic people with manufacturing jobs. You can find more about the program at wpr.org/centraltime.